Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. President Donald Trump has signed an executive order that directs the Department of Education to prioritize school choice programs through its discretionary grants. We're going to talk about this more with our friend Andrea Picciotti-Bear. This is a declaration of some good news. We need to expand upon what this means for all of us in an applied manner and what this might mean for the future of especially Catholic parents deciding for themselves how best to educate their children. We talked with Randall Smith after that because surveys have shown that Americans have an incredibly low view of Congress. The current approval rating hovers around 17%. The question, however, is how is it that 97% of incumbents win re-election if that is the case? If only 17%, if all of them only have a 17% approval rating, why do they keep winning re-elections over and over? So do people really disapprove of Congress, or do they just disapprove of other people's congressmen and women? We're going to talk about all of that in general and hopefully seek to regain and reestablish a proper way of thinking about our elected representatives. And then after, we're joined by Janice Breidenbach, who's a professor at my alma mater, Ave Maria University. Facebook's decision to suspend its third-party fact-checking system was met with applause and uproar, because many fear it would now be a platform for, quote-unquote, fake news and lies. But can we even have fact-checking in a world that rejects the very notion of truth? In fact, in a world that, frankly, if you take a look at commentators, they're calling this a post-truth world because moral and epistemological relativism rule the day. And if that's the case, then what are we fact-checking? What are the facts here that we are trying to adhere to? And what's objectively true? Because can we trust the fact-checkers? Who's watching the watchdogs? And can we trust the people who are watching the watchdogs? So we want to talk about truth and relativism in a grander picture with Janice Breidenbach. And hopefully for us, for all of us, that we can start developing our logical muscles, our intellectual muscles, for sifting through what's objectively true, good and beautiful, about the data that's being shoved at us, that we may live holy lives and happy lives. All this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, February 5th. It's the Feast of St. Agatha. And today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. President Trump says Palestinians must leave Gaza. Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met in the Oval Office Tuesday, with Trump saying the U.S. is prepared to take over the occupied territory. He did not rule out the possibility of sending in U.S. troops to help accomplish his vision. The Palestinian militant group Hamas, the de facto rulers of the Gaza Strip, called Trump's remarks ridiculous and said they carry with them the risk of igniting the region. Crews have recovered all 67 victims in last week's mid-air collision near Washington, D.C. An American Airlines plane collided with an Army Black Hawk helicopter, causing both to fall into the Potomac River. The cockpit and tail from the regional jet were recovered earlier in the day. A winter storm is expected to hit the Midwest and Northeast today. It's forecast to bring snow and ice to the regions. The wintry conditions are expected to continue through tomorrow. And there are still a few days until the big game, but companies are already unveiling their Super Bowl ads. Those who don't want to wait until Sunday to see the highly anticipated commercials can watch several online right now. This year's spots include an Uber Eats commercial starring Matthew McConaughey with cameos from Martha Stewart and Charlie XCX. Another sees Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal reuniting to recreate their famous When Harry Met Sally restaurant scene for Hellman's. Prices for ads during this year's Super Bowl reportedly broke records, with some spots selling for more than $8 million. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. President Donald Trump signed an executive order directing the Department of Education to prioritize school choice programs through discretionary grants. We'll talk more about this with Andrea Pachotti-Bear, who is a legal analyst for EWTN News, director of the Conscience Project, and who joins us every week to talk about religious freedom issues here in the United States of America. Andrea, I'm so glad to speak with you. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm super excited about great news. I feel like the turning, Marcus, for our conversations.
Yep.
I expect that they're going to be very, very positive moving forward.
I think so, too, and I was going to make the exact same comment. I realize you and I have been talking more and more about positive things in the past few weeks, so let's talk about this. So Catholic parents undoubtedly want to be excited. They just want to know details as to what's going on, so let's expand that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously people have been kind of in shock and awe with the number of executive orders that President Trump has issued in just a few weeks that he's been president. But one of the orders was issued on January 31st, and it's entitled Expanding Education Freedom and Opportunity for Families. And it really does represent kind of a sea change in the way that the federal government, especially the Education Department, considers education for American families and prioritizing giving parents choices. Those choices may include the public school system, but also allowing for choices beyond the public school system. And this is, you know, as a Catholic mother of 10, really important because having the choice of making sure that my children have a Christian education has been something that up until now it really has only involved financial sacrifice.
Right.
And instead, it looks like there can be greater assistance, especially for the most needy in our country.
Right. And one would think that at least on a constitutional level, Andrea, the right to school choice should be a no-brainer. It should be a logical overflow of anywhere from liberty to the right of parents to discern for themselves what's best for the upbringing of their children to become productive citizens of the nation.
Yeah, and we know that that's kind of basic primer for Catholic teaching on the role of parents. Parents as primary educators. It's gotten kind of mired down here in this country, first because of the monopoly that our public schools have over public education, and I personally think a confusion, a confused idea about what the Constitution requires, often leading people to think that the Constitution requires a secular education system for children, as opposed to one that really does represent the rich pluralistic character that's made our country great, strong, and unique.
Right. And okay, so even if they want to argue for a secular system of education ought to be able to entertain all those things that are objectively true, good, and beautiful that comes as the heritage of Western civilization. One that rejects that ceases to even be properly secular in appealing to the heritage we have.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And we've spoken in the past about efforts that are going on in different states to bring the great religious tradition of our country, especially as it's influenced our laws, into at least consideration and contemplation in our public schools. What really is wonderful here is, you know, competition in education will make all schools better. And I think that by widening opportunities, using federal grants to especially increase opportunities for families that maybe can't because they're lower income, or they're members of military, on Indian, you know, members of Indian tribes, these things just basically open up greater competition for our public schools to improve themselves. I think it's just great. It's a wonderful first step. And it's something, honestly, Marcus, that we have not seen, at least since I've been born, and I'm pretty old.
Well, okay, I beg to differ with that. But that being said, though, I agree with you. I haven't seen anything as this in a step in the right direction at the federal level. And I'm happy as a parent of very young children, because this conversation on school choice becomes a true concern when all that seems affordably available are public schooling systems, and when it's very clear that at least at the societal level, trust in the public schooling system to properly educate our children continues to wane.
No, absolutely. And we saw that especially during the pandemic. You know, I live in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and the shock and horror that parents saw when they were actually observing some of the curriculum and the courses that their children were taking online really caused a lot of people both to leave, to go to our parochial schools, other private Christian schools, but also had serious consequences for government. And in fact, we have a Republican governor, thanks in part to the fact that Governor Glenn Youngkin really reiterated the vital role of parents in their children's education. What's really unique, and this is people that have been in the school choice movement have really said, this is our moment, right?
Yes.
More and more states are looking at greater choice initiatives. And I think it's just important that we make sure that as we expand choice, that religious freedom be really part of the blueprints for that. Yeah. Otherwise, we could see it just repeating the kind of errors of the public school system.
Yep, I agree. And it seems like at least the terms of some level of religious freedom seems to have made it, especially when you think about the military provisions in this executive order. I'm reminded of something I read late last year. This was in Education Week, that the National Assessment of Educational Progress, they found post-pandemic, 38% of 8th graders in the United States couldn't meet the test's lowest requirements for them to graduate to the 9th grade. And so that's what, like almost 40% of them, right? And of course, the pandemic had a lot to do with it, but more and more we're seeing the reality that the public schooling system is failing or at least the system established, is not meeting the challenges necessary for properly educating our children.
No, and you're absolutely right. And the president's executive order did point out these serious considerations. Mm-hmm. What I think is really lovely is that by opening up greater options, we're going to be able to see the creativity that is really proving itself to be much more successful with kids that are achieving where they should be achieving,
yep.
Whether we're talking about charter schools or religious schools. Our Catholic schools are exceptional, doing what they do for, you know, on a very shoestring budget, but they have greater retention rates of students, and just all of these basic skills, they're able to do just much more effectively with the students and efficiently with the money that they receive. So it's really a wonderful time that we kind of wake up, see that our schooling, our educational system has not been serving families and children. And this is a boost, a really big boost to really improve what we offer across the board.
Yep. I couldn't agree more. So on a practical level for all of our listeners right now, what will these discretionary grants look like? And there's a limitation to who can access them and who will have access to the funds. So just tell us a little about that.
You know, some of that is going to be worked out, honestly, by the Department of Education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the president, as the chief executive, is directing the Department of Education to prioritize school choice. How that's going to kind of come into brass tacks is going to be through guidance about using these federal allocations for districts and schools. Again, we have to remember that our education system isn't a federally run system. It's directed at the state level, even though the Department of Education has a considerable role in setting the standards. So there's a lot to be seen for how this is going to play out. We also, as I mentioned in the piece that I wrote for the National Catholic Register on this issue, there's an issue coming before the Supreme Court this term, and that's about a really unique charter school in Oklahoma, which hopefully will allow Catholic schools to take their place in the charter school program as well.
Yep, St. Isidore. So I look forward to speaking with you more about this. Andrea, thank you very much for making the time.
Thanks, Marcus.
My guest, Andrea Picciotti-Bayer, legal analyst for EWTN News. We've been talking about President Donald Trump's executive order to greater expand support for school choice across the country. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes, without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tamio, weekdays and Ave Maria Radio.
I encourage you to look at a report that came out several years ago by Americans United for Life. It's called Unsafe. And this idea is something else that has been pushed out there by the media and by Planned Parenthood and other pro-abortion organizations, that there are all these safety measures that were put into place when Roe versus Wade became legal. But as Father Frank Pavone and so many others say, abortion never, ever, ever changed, really. It went from the back alley to Main Street with little or no restrictions or protections. Many of the independent abortion facilities are less regulated than your local nail salon or hair salon. The fact that they have to, quote unquote, work on their messaging shows that we are making a difference.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tamio, weekday mornings from 8 to 10 on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
This week on Christ is the Answer, Father John wants to talk about being transformed. The Eucharist, it's the source and summit of our lives as Christians. We know it to be Jesus himself, but do we know what Jesus is doing through this precious gift for us? Join us this week as Father John shows us how to pray like Jesus, as well as expounding on how through the Eucharist, Jesus transforms us to be more like him. Tune in for Christ is the Answer, Monday through Fridays at 11 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Surveys have shown that Americans have an incredibly low view of Congress. The current approval rating hovers around 17%. How is it that 97% of incumbents win re-election? Do people really disapprove of Congress, or do they just disapprove of other people's congressmen and women? Randall Smith joins us. Randall is professor of theology at University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas, and he is the author of this article in The Catholic Thing, Whose Reform? Which Special Interest? Randall, great to speak with you again. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you always have great pieces, so I love talking about them with you. And I will say this dichotomy has been hovering in the forefront of my mind for a while. It's an abysmal 17% approval rating. I think most of our listeners knows this particular fact. But like you mentioned, 97% of congressmen and women running for office actually get reelected. And so that dichotomy ought to present to us as a logical issue, as a logical antithesis. So let's frame the conversation there. What's going on?
Well, as I suggest, as you read, I wonder whether people are really disapprove of Congress or they just disapprove of other people's congressmen and women.
Mm-hmm.
They say things like, we want to drain the swamp, but they don't want to start with their own swamp creature. They want to cut special interests, right, and, make sure that these horrible special interests aren't getting all this money. But it's not so clear to me that they're interested in cutting their own special interests.
Right.
And so, as I point out in the article, I think you're going to start seeing, and you've already started to see, articles about how horribly, some person X is now being treated, or their lives are in disarray somehow because there's no longer government program Y. So in some sense, the reform has got to start with all of us, because all of us in our own ways have become dependent on the, let's just right now, we're just talking about the federal government.
Yeah. And at the federal level, too, you do a good job of highlighting that it's not just the issue of governance and nobility and conduct. It's also a matter of budgets and the allocation of funding. And we have no issues when the budgets are allocated towards our seemingly noble ends, but we have particular issues when they are ordered towards these things that we don't care about, which on the one hand, one might argue is the hallmark of the democratic process. But on the other hand, I think it speaks to a certain kind of denigration in collective virtue and mission and responsibility of the populace of the United States.
Yeah, and you know, a loss of a sense of the common good. The joke I always, when I'm talking about the common good, I'm teaching Thomas Aquinas, and the joke I tell my students here is, well, it's not exactly a joke, but, you know, it's an irony, as I say, you know, what's more important than education? Education is the most important thing. Why would we spend billions and billions of dollars on roads and highways when education is clearly more important? Well, I know that at some point one of my little students will raise his or her hand and go, Professor Smith, I have to drive on those roads, right? I can't get to school if, you know, Highway 59 is not clear. And I'm like, yes, I understand that. I live near campus, so I don't have to drive on those highways, but having, you know, an infrastructure which allows people to get around is very, very important. Mm-hmm. Now, again, I don't particularly like to drive on highways, and I try to stay off them as much as possible. But yeah, many, many people, obviously millions of people do drive on them. So it's not just a question of what I like,
right,
what I want, and what benefits me, right? There's a whole series of things going on in my city, my state, my nation, that are worthy of support in various and sundry ways. And so we have to make some decisions based upon, you know, sort of a hierarchy of goods.
Right. And the example you mentioned has a particular place for those of us in our hearts, for those of us who live in Michigan, because Michigan potholes are a running joke for a reason. So removing funding from highway repairs, them's fighting words. But you're right, though. While we all have our vested interests, there is an objective proportionate hierarchy of ethical goods, of moral goods. And every one of us has an obligation to understand what this looks like. And our electoral choices, and hopefully those we elect to public office, will all share that knowledge and appeal to that order and the common good.
Yeah, and I say in the article, for example, for people who say, and look, again, these are broad considerations, and I've not made any judgments about mm-hmm. anybody's particular program, but I do say that, for example, when some congressman or senator comes back and says, I got billions of dollars or thousands, millions of dollars, whatever it is, for this program or this thing or this center or, you know, this bridge, the logical response to that, it seems to me, on the part of people who want to drain the swamp, as mm-hmm. it were, would be, you did what? You can't do that. If you bring home pork barrel spending for us, every other congressman and senator is going to do the same thing in their districts, and then pretty soon the whole country is bankrupt, and that's what's happened. So you give that money back, right? That doesn't belong to us. But I don't think people are going to say that, right?
Yeah.
Again, when people bring home earmarks for their district, everyone's allotting them, you know.
Yep.
Whereas my view would be, you know, I mean, I like money for education, but there is a way in which it's like, look, that's money, that's not my money, that's money which is taken from taxpayers to, you know, take care of the common good.
Right. And this presents that more expansive conversation as a Thomist that you are. You see the problem of entitlement when it comes to access to these funds, and therefore entitlement and rights, without the corresponding moral responsibility owed, because I don't own these funds. Taxpayer funds are therefore the funds of the populace, and they have to be governed well and with true transparency and morality.
Yeah, I say, for example, just in my own area, in education, you know, we were joking about this before, but that in the Chronicle of Higher Education, et cetera, you know, you're starting to see articles about, oh, my goodness, what's happening now with, I mean, it's starting in a lot of areas, Trump administration, and what if this gets cut and that gets cut? And of course, you know, in something like the Chronicle of Education, oh, my goodness, there's going to be cuts in educational spending. And this is bemoaned and worried about, and it's good reason in certain ways. But at the same time, you know, as state governments try to influence, you know, public universities to have a different kind of education, et cetera, this is deeply resented, which is to say, okay, we want you to spend lots of money on us, right? We have a right to these. This is very important. And again, I believe education is very important. But we want no control. We have rights, but no responsibility to the public for the money. And that strikes me as, well, you know, corrupt. I mean, you know, not particularly well thought out. In a similar way that, again, it's like I never quite understood when Joe Biden or whoever it is says, oh, I'm giving billions to for student loan relief. The point is, Joe, you don't have any money. That's your money. That's everyone else's money.
That's right.
A congressman and senators and presidents, they don't have any money. I mean, now, again, if Donald Trump wants to take whatever he's got, like $2 or $3 billion, and spend it on something, well, that's fine. If he wants to sort of say, well, I'll throw $2 billion into the pot. But, you know, to sort of say, well, I'm going to take, you know, taxpayers from Idaho and use their money, you know, to relieve student loan debt. It's like, well, okay, I mean, maybe that's a good decision to make, but I don't know, perhaps the voters should, you know, agree to that before somebody makes themselves look very generous by giving away other people's money. You can be very generous, I found, if you give away other people's money.
And that's a real question, right? In the objective order of morality, that's not true generosity. In fact, one might argue that at the end of the day, that's true stewardship, because you don't wipe away debt, you just transfer the debt somewhere, and that's a basic understanding of how the fiscal system works here. So as we continue to talk about this and think, and Randall, first of all, thank you very much for making the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
My guest, Randall Smith, who is a professor of theology at University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas, we've been talking about a certain sense of morality as to our elected officials and what we hold them to account for. And what Randall is arguing is completely right. We need to realign ourselves in objective moral order so that we live rightly, think rightly, and hold our elected officials to moral accountability. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
I've seen the difference in my son since he's been at Ave Maria. He's happy, he's excited about what he's going to do with his degree, and he's living his faith.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jingle.
In Rule 2 of St. Ignatius of Loyola's teaching on the discernment of spirits, he describes the characteristics of a person whose fundamental spiritual direction of their lives is directed towards God. He writes, "In persons who are going on intensely purifying their sins and rising from good to better in the service of God our Lord, St. Ignatius is describing persons who love God intensely and want to live their lives in conformity to His will. These persons frequent the sacrament of reconciliation, sin is being uprooted, and virtue is flourishing. They are striving to grow in holiness and are giving more of their time to the service of the Lord." With attentive care to the spiritual life, the person portrayed in Rule 2 is the image of the growing and maturing Christian. Is there an area in your life that needs to rise from good to better? Grace awaits.
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net.
Blessed Carlo Acutis is quoted as saying, "Continuously ask your guardian angel for help. Your guardian angel has to become your best friend." We all have traveling companions, our guardian angels walking with us through life. How often are you communicating with your angel? Jesus said, "I send you an angel before you to protect you, to accompany you along the path so that you do not make mistakes." According to the tradition of the Catholic Church, each of us has a guardian angel who protects us and helps make us aware of things around us. In his Angels in 2021, Pope Francis noted that oftentimes we have that feeling that I should do this, or this is not right, or be careful. That's the voice of our guardian angel. We don't walk alone. Not listening to our guardian angel's advice, however, the Pope says, is like telling him to go away. It's dangerous to chase away our traveling companion. This has been a Christ Center Communication Message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, a communications evangelist and host of Epiphany.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, Pope St. John Paul II reminds us that the Catholic Church breathes with both lungs, East and West. There are actually 21 different ancient and venerable ways to be Catholic.
Now on Ave Maria Radio's newest FM stations, 105.5 FM in Southfield and 107.9 FM in Ann Arbor.
Support for this Ave Maria Radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Facebook's decision to suspend its third-party fact-checking system was met with both applause and uproar. Many people feared it would open a platform for fake news and lies. And the question that it raises is, can we actually have fact-checking in what many commentators, especially philosophical commentators, are calling a post-truth world, a world that rejects the very notion of truth? We want to talk about the grander questions of truth and relativism with Janice Breidenbach. Janice Chick Breidenbach is an associate professor in the philosophy department at Ave Maria University and my alma mater, so I'm really glad to be speaking with her. Janice, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
Hi, Marcus. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. And it's wonderful, by the way, to be speaking to a graduate of Ave Maria University, a very fine university.
Oh, truly, very fine university. You know what? Let's just spend the next two segments singing the praises of Ave. I would happily do that.
You anticipated that.
Well, but it really does bring me a particular sense of joy whenever I get to connect with anywhere from old professors to new friends from Ave. Yes, because of my affinity for the institution, but also largely the resonance of the mission, which is this driving forward, this transformation of the culture towards the pursuit of objective truth, goodness, and beauty in adherence to fidelity to the magisterium. And that's where I want to begin this conversation. We have lost our sense of objective truth. And Ave Maria University is doing a wonderful job of making sure we reclaim that at the lowest level of its educational system.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, you know, from your, you know, very expert theological perspective as well, I mean, I think, you know, we agree that there's something about the kinds of Catholic liberal arts universities such as Ave Maria University that are really leading society by example. At this moment in which, you know, I think the way that you've framed the problem is exactly right, you know, with the kind of paradox or maybe even contradiction in fact-checking in a context in which people don't seem to really recognize, you know, truth as something, you know, fixed and staple. And, yeah, so, I mean, I think the way you frame it is exactly right.
And
it's very clever, yeah.
If I may draw from a mutual love of ours, I'm familiar with your work, with Michael's work, and Pope Benedict XVI and his thought. In 2006, the Regensburg Address, I know you know it well, and Ratzinger went on the public sphere, at that point Pope Benedict went on the public sphere, and essentially said that the beast of our day is relativism, and boy was he prophetic and so unappreciated at that point. Owing to many ebbs and flows in the philosophical development of the culture, we have allowed ourselves to come to a point where we don't even have the answer to what is truth. And if that is the case, we can't begin to pursue what is fact and what's not fact.
Yeah, it really is true. I mean, you know, Pilate's question, what is truth, when you really confront it, is probably the most tragic, baffling question in the history of the world, really.
Yeah.
I don't think that's overstating it, right? I mean, the tragedy of posing that question to Truth himself, and walking away, you know, from the answer that is in front of one. The situation that we're in, I think, is one that is very complex, because it's not clear to people who ask that question, you know, what they're missing out on. I mean, there's definitely a kind of false intellectual modesty,
right,
you know, going on with the relativism and the pluralism. Does truth matter to people anymore, you know, when, you know, it's assumed that everything is relative and there is nothing fixed? And, you know, I mean, in the history of the world, really, we've seen forms of extreme skepticism sort of take hold of civilizations, you know, starting with Descartes.
Right.
You know, they just even, you know, questioning whether, you know, your own body is there or not. You know, this is absolutely extreme kind of skepticism that, you know, then I think is a very close cousin, really, to the kind of pluralism that makes ideological diversity itself a kind of compulsory condition, you know, of our daily lives, in which, you know, we kind of like force one another to be subject to a diversity of viewpoints,
mm-hmm.
you know, but we don't really want to articulate precisely, you know, how these viewpoints differ. They're kind of all presented as being of equal merit, none of them best or truest, you know, we could say. I think there definitely is this in the background. It's pretty incoherent. It's tragic, you know, just on its own merits, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, of course, like kind of the close relatives of this kind of incoherent, you know, relative pluralism. And I guess you could say like subjectivism mm-hmm. and emotivism. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with like C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man,
yeah.
you know, in which he really, I think, articulates so well, just, you know, that the problems with this kind of, I think it's kind of close relative of relativism when,
mm-hmm.
you know, we say that there is a kind of equality of all thoughts, equality of all subjects. And simply because, like, for us, like, everything, you know, every moral judgment, according to the subjectivist, is based not on reason or rational discourse, but rather our emotional impressions.
Yeah.
You know, so everything is, I mean, there's just something, well, I think, you and I are both converts. You know, I too came from a position of, I don't know, maybe you were more of an atheist than I was, but, you know, I was a practical atheist,
mm-hmm.
Who, you know, read the Bible because I was searching,
uh-huh.
you know, I kind of my whole life. And, you know, there's just something I think that Lewis is expressing in Abolition of Man, when, you know, he says these subjectivists, these relativists are rejecting what he calls the Tao. So he uses a Chinese word. It's really interesting.
Yes,
but,
yes.
You know, if you recall, right, this word Tao, like, sometimes, like, trips people up because it's like, well, why use, you know, this East Asian word? You know, and I think there's some sense in which, of course, Lewis wants to express the universality of truth, of traditional values, that we can't not know, as my former professor and mentor at Texas, Jay Bujaszewski, used to say. You know, I mean, he has a book, you know, the things that we can't not know. There's just something very deeply incoherent about all of this emotivism and the subjectivism. I don't know, I mean, just every ism, right? Skepticism.
Except Catholicism, I'd say.
Yeah, that's right. And we are here where we are because of that.
Yep.
So,
And to your credit, you were a more intellectual atheist than I was. I was just an angry atheist. I wasn't practical atheist.
Well, I may have had my own bit of... Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can be an atheist without being a little bit angry.
That's fair.
At the world.
That's
right?
Very fair.
I mean,
I made that argument.
Something, yeah, I mean, if there is no God, there's no fixed source, you know, of truth.
Yeah.
And it's as if some creator who doesn't exist, because you posit that he doesn't, has just left you to your own devices to figure out, you know, the order in the world that, you know, I mean, is just kind of impossible, right? Without, outside of the, you know, as you mentioned, Ratzinger's, Regensburg address, right? Outside of that framework, it's near impossible for us.
And in fact, you just highlighted a core component of this entire conversation. When I was an atheist, Nietzsche was a hero, but I misunderstood right. even the tragedy that befell him and the way he thought. I read the Gay Science, his book, The Gay Science, and his Parable of the Madman as if it were triumphalistic. It took me a long time to realize he was bemoaning the fact that in our empiricist revolution, we had murdered God in the public sphere, and we were inviting destruction upon ourselves because we destroyed the structure of objectivity. So I'm going to open that conversation there. leaving 30 seconds in this segment. my guest is Dr. Janice Chick Breidenbach. She's an associate professor in the philosophy department at Ave Maria University. We are talking about the nature of truth and the great beast that is relativism, that many of you listening right now know friends, family members, children who are in one way, shape, or form epistemologically grappling with this problem of relativism. And the fact is, there's no such thing as multiple truths. There is an objective truth, and his name is Jesus Christ. And we will continue this conversation on the other side of the break with Janice. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Remember to take a minute this week to thank a priest you know for all the blessings he shares through his vocation. Our priests work tirelessly to bring us the sacraments and help us on our journey to heaven. Let's encourage them and express our gratitude for all of their sacrifices, like thank you for baptizing our children. Nominate your priest at thankyouforyourpriesthood.com, a new contest every month through September 2025, brought to you by Diocesan, your Catholic advertising and communications company.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Too often we parents get so caught up in the day-to-day grind of family life, appointments, chores, emails, and so on, that we don't spend enough time on our most important job, spiritually parenting our kids. What is spiritual parenting? It's nothing more than capturing our kids' hearts and then doing what we can to bring their hearts to God. The liturgy of domestic church life provides the rituals and routines we need to be good spiritual parents. Prioritizing family time, being extravagant in our affection and affirmation, serving one another generously and cheerfully, and practicing gentle discipleship discipline. Ultimately, spiritual parenting is about helping our kids recognize their inherent worth so that they, in turn, can love God and others wholeheartedly. To find out more about spiritual parenting, check out our books, Parenting Your Kids with Grace and Parenting Your Teens and Tweens with Grace, or visit CatholicHOM.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
What is God's most amazing quality? Surely it must be His enormous mercy towards sinners. This mercy is revealed in the gospel through Jesus Christ. Jesus' very name means salvation from sin. The Eucharist is the sacrament of redemption, we learn from the Catechism of the Catholic Church. In order to receive this mercy, however, we must know and acknowledge that we indeed have sinned and are in need of forgiveness. If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, St. John's Gospel reminds us. But if we confess our sins, God will cleanse us of all unrighteousness. John Paul II asserted that conversion requires convincing of sin. As a physician must probe a wound before treating it, God, through His Word and His Spirit, casts a living light on sin. But along with the sting of conscience comes the salve of the certainty of redemption. So the Spirit of Truth is also the consoler. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Marcus Peter hosts Unveiling the Covenants.
What is a covenant? It's a vowed exchange of lives which results in an unbreakable family bond. Throughout Scripture, God seeks to espouse all mankind to Himself in an unbreakable covenant bond. His covenantal love is a free gift, but it necessitates a response from us. We are free to accept or reject it. Let's learn what this means as we unveil the covenants.
Saturday mornings at 11 and Sunday morning at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Dr. Janice Breidenbach, Associate Professor in the Philosophy Department at Ave Maria University, and we're talking about truth and relativism. So, Janice, you had introduced the concept of Nietzsche and ultimately how atheism is going to render you angry. And you also brought up the French philosophers. Gosh, what an angry... I can only imagine that whenever they gathered together, it must have been some of the most miserable conversations ever. Voltaire... Voltaire, cherish those who seek the truth, but beware of those who find it. Mm-hmm. Are you insane? Mm-hmm. But and, or worse, like I quote Jean-Jacques Rousseau all the time, mm-hmm. just because of how absurd some of his thoughts were. But the truth brings no man a fortune. The misery that has been induced by the French Enlightenment movement and how it's seeped into and informed our modern culture. Comment on it, and also just let us know why we need a corrective from it.
Yeah, it's insightful, and I mean it's insane, but it's interesting, you know. I mean, for better or for worse, from a philosophical angle anyway. I mean, I know theologians would just, you know, I mean, just let's move on, right? I mean, I think what's so interesting about people like Rousseau and Nietzsche, though, is that, you know, they, in some sense, we see in a kind of evolution or development of mm-hmm. the relativism and subjectivism into a kind of hyper-absolutism. There's a kind of secular magisterium that gets set up, and you see this as, you know, the kind of driving horrific force of the French Revolution, which, you know, I'm not an historian, but my husband is, he could speak more on that, you know, but there's some sense in which we definitely see that in our society, right, with mm-hmm. the cancel culture and the, you know, just the, you know, I mean, our students are, I mean, it might have been, you know, a few decades ago that secular universities thought, okay, like, we need to teach students how to think. We're not going to teach them what to think. Mm-hmm. But today we definitely find, you know, a kind of indoctrination of certain ideologies, as a matter of dogma, you know, without the tools, you know, for critical thought or rational discourse that, you know, we might have actually armed ourselves with before. So, you know, I mean, it's so interesting, though. You kind of see in the very seeds of the ancient period, you know, with Plato. I mean, maybe this is controversial, but I actually think Plato was the first fact checker, you know. I mean, it's, you know, some of your listeners may know, like, he really didn't like Homer. You know, and he was just very serious, and earnest about Homer's, you know, poetical depiction of the gods, which he thought, you know, is very problematic. And of course, I think there's a lot to sympathize mm-hmm. with what he's saying about the moral significance of poetry, you know, and the way in which people take stories like this, which are so compelling and yet may have fictional aspects, you know, that we need to be careful about. So that's kind of like a really ancient starting point, you know, for thinking about, okay, like, to what extent should we allow for mythos, right? That, you know, isn't, like, we understand that it's not true, but at the same time, like, there is a kind of ethical dimension, you know, to things. And Plato is kind of offering that as a kind of test case, you know, from the very beginning. And in the Apology, right, sort of questions about, you know, well, who's evil, right? Like, do we, like, who's good? Who's corruption? Who's God? You know, who gets to decide? And at bottom, like, that's the problem with, you know, I mean, if we're framing this as a kind of Facebook fact-checking, you know, the problem with automatic censorship, mm-hmm. At bottom, there is a kind of, fundamentally, it's an affront to human freedom, right, that we're not allowing people to, you know, in you know, the growth of their education and their maturity, we're not allowing them to make their own decisions, to form their own thoughts. And it is a kind of thought police, right? And it's condescending, and it's a kind of violence to democracy, actually.
Yes.
You know, for us to allow this sort of thing. But at the same time, I think, yeah, there definitely is, you know, a search for truth that we all have to engage in. And if anything, I think the Catholic University is, you know, the place where we, you know, really fearlessly, I think you've alluded to this already, fearlessly, you know, want to seek this, this unison between mm-hmm. faith and reason. It's that's what really drives us to the commitment, you know, that we have to thought, you know, and to the furtherance of our education and reasoning well. But you know, yeah, I mean, you and I are, I mean, we're Christian, and we believe that there are these truths that you know, not even, you know, even non-Christians can affirm.
Yes.
Right? I mean, that's the natural law, the
exactly.
things that we can't not know.
And again, you appeal to Budaczewski here. And by the way, I'm a huge fan of his work.
He's great.
You probably would have surmised that. But
yeah.
Just based on everything you've shared, that's why there's a certain sense of superiority to the systematic thought of Aristotle and Aquinas. Not because I want to claim an absolutist authority over their framework, largely because they facilitate a synthetic capacity of training your thinking well so that you are free to engage all other thoughts and sift through what's true and what's good and what's not. And like you mentioned, there was a point in society where it was presupposed that this was how we were training, you know, like these logical epistemological frameworks. We were training children to grow into those capacities. But because we no longer do that, our pedagogy is purely empiricist, it's purely materialist, and, you know, like, we school children that they may get jobs. We're not schooling them to think rightly, think well, and live the good life and be good people. And then we wonder why they're being indoctrinated so easily by every ebb and flow of the culture.
That's really beautifully put, really. You know, I mean, C.S. Lewis said we're stripping people of that, of precisely that power, right? Not only to think well, but to do well.
Right.
You know, and to be good, right? So, like, there, in some interesting sense, I mean, truth is both theoretical as well as practical, and these things are linked. And in some sense, I think, yeah, what you're saying about education, at the heart of it, I think, of course, I'm a philosopher, so I think this, right? I think it has to be a kind of training of how to ask questions.
Right.
You know, how to, and not just like how to ask questions as if it's like some kind of skill or something, but.
Right,
you know,
we're not
really
training
like
journalists,
kind of,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, that's fine, I guess,
yeah.
Right? But there's something in the heart that I think Socratic dialogue is wanting us to cultivate, which
right.
is a willingness in our heart, in our disposition, at all times, to ask questions and to try to answer them. And, you know, I mean, really, this is what the ancients thought was a virtue.
Yep.
And likewise, trying to answer a question, a difficult question, it can take, you know, it takes courage, right? It's like one has to kind of take a leap sometimes and give it a try and be willing, you know, to be proven wrong and, you know, lose faith a little bit, you know, but there's some sense in which, I mean, this is what marked, you know, the difference between the philosopher who is a lover of wisdom and the sophist in ancient times, right? The sophist
right.
was someone who sort of framed himself as, well, I am a wise man, mm-hmm. right? I am the wise one. So, you know, you can pay me, right, if you want, you know, to hear truth. And, you know, sophists, of course, would say what people already, you know, believe, like what people wanted to hear. And Socrates basically said, well, you know, are you asking the right questions?
Right.
And, you know, do you have this sense of wonder at the world, at ourselves? And I just think that's like such a magnificent thing, you know, in a true education. It's not an education that I got, I have to say. You know, I went to an Ivy League institution that didn't have the kinds of classes that we offer to our students. So really, I think, you know, it's just so wonderful to, you know, teach young people and, you know, and cultivate in ourselves constantly this question, why?
Yep.
You know, which is really, you know, fundamentally, I think, at the heart of our need, our desire for the truth that set us free.
Yes.
right? I mean, and I think that is a universal desire.
Yep.
That, you know, isn't just going to ring true for Christians. It's going to ring true for everyone. And somehow, like, that's, I mean, the rapprochement between faith and reason, you know, in our religion is such a great thing, right?
Yep.
Because it allows us to see, like, truth. You know, if truth is really what we think it is, then it has to be true no matter what the circumstances are. It's going to be true, you know, in every context.
Yep. And throughout
and somehow
history.
faith and reason give us that.
Yep. And like you mentioned, my entire journey, first from militant atheism to Christianity, then into Catholicism, was this journey of being proven wrong at every juncture.
Yeah, I know.
And I thank God for the work of grace that led me to study the right things. But like you, these resources were not made available to me, and they were the result of anywhere from grace and finding them at the right place, right time, and self-study. But that's a heritage we need to reclaim, that asking questions rightly and endowing our children with the resources necessary to help them frame these objective standards of thinking so that they can then engage these things at the popular level.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as a fellow convert, it's really poignant and beautiful, especially to study, you know, like the lines of Plato, right, where he says that the person who seeks the truth becomes truly the friend of God.
Right.
I mean, it's just such a great line because, you know, it like this is like an ancient, you know, totally pre-Christian era, right, in which like this philosopher who said, you know, I mean, sometimes he gets things wrong, you know, but, you know, he recognizes that, you know, the pursuit of wisdom is actually a pursuit of divine friendship, like a friendship with a person. And there's just something so incredible about that. And I just think, like, too, like very, very much illustrating the nature of friendship in the way that we are supposed to be good educators,
right?
But, like teaching our students not just, okay, like how to ask questions and stuff, but like how to be a good friend,
right?
You know, like in conversation with one another.
Right. Or how to be a good mother, like your course, The Philosophy of Motherhood, which my bride actually signed up for.
Thank you. Yeah, Thank you for your time, Janice.
thank
you, Marcus.
My guest, Dr. Janice Breidenbach, Associate Professor in the Philosophy Department at Ave Maria University. Let us learn to think rightly and teach our children to do the same. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.